and welcome to the 7th episode of Cabin Fever, this week with me, Beth Rose. We're just about getting used to living a very different 2020 to the one we probably all expected. I'm not sure anyone really saw this coming. But can you imagine starting a brand new job on the 11th of March 2020, the day the World Health Organization declared a global pandemic? What about if that first day was restarting your nursing career after 12 years of recovery from severe mental illness? For Hannah McDonald, that's exactly what happened. Over the past 12 years, she's experienced mental health crises, including being detained under the Mental Health Act. But she's also spent time topping up her medical training, determined to get back to the career she loved. And now she's regarded by the Royal College of Nursing as an expert by experience to support the mental health of all nurses. Just before we get going, Hannah is really open about her story from the most difficult times in her life to her brilliant success. But that does mean we talk about subjects like self-harm and suicide. Hi, Hannah.
Hello, hi.
How are things going?
Yeah, they're going all right. It's quite strange to have started nursing. We're in a completely different time for nursing anyway, never mind for me after 12 years of mental illness.
Yeah, I don't imagine you ever expected your first day to be the day a global pandemic was declared.
No, not at all. And I don't think the people I'm working with expected that either.
So let's sort of go back to the beginning, or I guess it's probably more the middling. And it's really horrible to boil someone's life down like this, but sometimes it can be a bit helpful. So you have a medical diagnosis of emotionally unstable personality disorder, which is also sometimes known as borderline personality disorder. And I know we kind of hear those names bandied about a bit, but what does that actually mean to you?
To me, actually, when I was first given the diagnosis, it was quite horrible because I think for me, it felt like my personality was disordered. It sort of felt like a real stab into the very core of who I was. Actually, I was to learn that it meant that I hadn't really been emotionally nurtured as a child. And there's been some very big events in my life. By the time I was 18 years old, I'd had a friend who had drowned, a friend who had taken their own life, and I'd had a friend who had been murdered. And I think that all of those deaths had an impact. But because they were friends, nobody saw how much these had impacted me. And actually, my understanding now was actually I was somebody who was unable to deal with that grief. And I buried it to the point that when I did have my mental health breakdown, I was completely confused about why I was unhappy as I was and why I couldn't manage to be a nurse. But I think what it was that nursing was triggering that pain. For me, my mental illness was undealt with grief because, unfortunately, being from quite a large family and one of 8 children, I think that nobody really was able to work it through with me.
So did you pack all this away?
Yes.
You were about 18, 19?
Yeah, I was 18 years old, but I then moved away from home and it just all got buried. I'm actually, by personality, quite an optimist. Which people find quite surprising when I've had such a serious mental illness, because I was always trying to see the bright of life and I didn't have that balance, because actually I think it's a balance of realising the pain of this world with also a balance of seeing that there are joys in it as well. And that got unbalanced. It just all then fell apart as that pain just got too big and I couldn't manage it.
And was that when you were working?
Yeah, I think so. And I was seeing other people's pain around. And then I just couldn't deal with that emotional pain that was inside me. And I had to deal with my own before I could really effectively look after other people. I think I learned that in the cruelest way. But I think as nurses, I think we need to think about that.
How did it start becoming apparent to maybe you or maybe your friends, family, your colleagues that things weren't quite as normal?
I think it was over quite a number of years. I had a friend that I was living with for 5 years, and she said there was always a part that she couldn't get to with me. But I don't think that anybody really knew. That was part of the problem. And when I actually was sectioned, because I was sectioned with my nursing uniform on my back.
So on the way to a shift?
Yeah, I was supposed to do a shift that day. And I had been seeing like a psychologist, and he was then concerned about me. And nobody, I think, knew how bad it was. I was secretly hurting myself. And when I was sectioned, my manager and the people I work with were absolutely shocked. And I didn't tell everybody. And most of them thought, actually, I may have left work because of having a cancer diagnosis. And so I think I was burying it so much, even though we can all look back and say, oh, that was a bit of a sign. The fact I wasn't really sleeping properly, the fact I wasn't really eating properly. But actually, it wasn't massively obvious. There were like these little signs. You know, I was still sort of functioning and I was doing quite a good job as a nurse. But actually, it was all coming on top of me and then I just broke. But I would say that that build-up was over probably 5 years. But actually, when I look back, I had suicidal thoughts from about the age of 12. I didn't act on those until I was 26. So if you're thinking about when did it start, it actually started when my first friend died.
What makes it specifically borderline personality disorder?
They have 9 categories. And if you have 5 or more, you're classed as that. And I, at that time, had 5. So I kind of was borderline on borderline.
Yeah.
In a way. The big thing was me was because I was unable to emotionally care for myself. I kept saying I wasn't angry. And I was very angry. I couldn't quite understand some of the emotions I was feeling, like abandonment. Because our emotional needs haven't been met as children, you're wanting people to try and care for you. And there's often low self-esteem because you haven't really been lifted up. Another big one, obviously, is that you've started to kind of self-harm. For me, the way that I describe self-harm is that it was my expression of my pain, which I couldn't describe in any other way.
And when you went to this appointment and the psychologist said to you, I think we need to detain you under the Mental Health Act.
He actually did a risk assessment form on me. And he then asked me if I'd ever thought of suicide. And I said yes. And then he'd asked me if I'd done anything towards trying to do that. And I went silent. And then he dug a bit and then he realised I actually was hurting myself. Because of that concern, he then took me to the emergency psychiatric service. And it was at that point where I was then seen by a doctor and then a mental health assessment was then done on me. And at that point, I was so overwhelmed. I didn't actually know what was happening to me. Because I was a nurse, people thought that I might understand. But actually, I didn't. I was a physical healthcare nurse. I worked in HIV. I had no clue what was going on. And then they just said, we're sectioning you. And that was just terrifying. I remember just thinking, that's it. I'm never going to be a nurse again. In that very first moment, my whole world just fell apart. I sort of entered a system where I was meeting people who had been in that system for sort of 20 years. And I just thought, this is it. This is now my life. You lose your role. You lose how you see yourself. You lose your hopes because you think, who's going to want to have a relationship with me now? And so it's bigger than people think. You then have to deal with the stigma, the self-stigma, but also the losses. You're physically going to hospital and what you lose.
And it sounds like it came as actually quite a big surprise.
Yes. And I went through many years thinking, what could I have done to stop that? Why didn't I get help? Why didn't I go to my manager? And yet, unfortunately, wasn't able. I've had to sort of find compassion myself that I didn't have the skills to ask for help. I thought it was a failure to say I'm struggling. But at the same time, that was 27-year-old Hannah, not 40-year-old Hannah, who's been on the journey that I've been on. You know, I know it's difficult to talk about emotions. Emotions can be painful. But that's why I say it's really important that we don't judge each other, because we can't actually help what we feel.
Did you get any reassurances when you were initially sectioned that this was not the end of Hannah?
There was people saying that to me, but at the same time, I didn't believe it. And I used to say at that time, I'd rather no hope than false hope. So when people said that to me, it felt like a false hope, because in one way, I had nurses saying that to me. But what I was seeing was people who'd be in revolving doors of mental health units that were going in and out, in and out, and in and out, had been for 20 years. So when that's what you're seeing, you generally think, well, that's the case here. And at that time, there wasn't any real peer support. So there wasn't any seeing anybody who'd got through it. And that's why, for me, peer support is massive.
What's it like the initial few weeks?
It takes a lot from you. I wasn't allowed to do embroidery, which is massive for me because of the risk, scissors and needles and things. They're very barren places because of that. That doesn't really work because the more that was taken off me, the more I was sitting in a barren room, looking around, thinking, how can I end my life? It's quite restricted in visiting hours. They only allow people to visit between 4 and 8. Most of my friends by that time were married and having children. Well, anybody with children, visiting hours between 4 and 8 is completely impossible. And you're trying to put these children to bed. And so a lot of my friends struggled because a lot of them weren't able to visit me. And so you become more isolated. For me, I was watching the busy nurses and the nurses. And it's like one of those film scenes where you have the one person just standing there and then everyone's just busy around them. You just feel useless. And that makes your self-esteem go down. I understand it on one level because they want to try and keep people safe. So it becomes a real balancing game. And interesting enough, the hospital that I then was to go to 5 years. So I spent 5 years in acute mental health units.
Full time, is that?
Yeah, pretty much about 80% of my time. Because I couldn't then cope outside of the hospital because my life was just in rubble.
Did you also find that 5 years of inpatient care and then you suddenly go outside again and had your security flipped? So you're returning to a very alien world once more.
Yes, and in a world that you don't feel part of anymore. And so in some ways you feel safer then. You become quite institutionalised. But actually the hospital is depriving you of so much. And so that's why I think you have these revolving doors. I was so fortunate because I got sent to a therapeutic community. And so it works very differently. In acute mental health units, you might talk to some of the nurses about how you're feeling. In a therapeutic community, you have to talk about your feelings with the whole community. And when I first went, I was like, no way, I want to tell everybody about how I'm feeling. Actually, they are able to help you once you kind of realise the benefits of it because they understand more than the staff do sometimes. And the patients were the ones that began to challenge me. And we had lots of kind of group therapy. We lived together, basically. We cooked together. And we used to have night contact. So, whether, you know, if we thought we're going to have a difficult night and you would sit together for an hour. And it was very different. There was no locked doors. You chose to be there, had a massive garden. It had knives in the kitchen. And I was allowed to do my embroidery. But interestingly enough, I made no attempts on my life at the Castle Hospital, where I'd made quite a number of attempts on my life in acute mental health units. The difference for me was on the acute mental health ward, they contain you physically, but not emotionally. Where in the therapy community, they didn't contain me physically. I could have left any time, but they did contain us emotionally. But what was very difficult about it was it's a time treatment. I was there for 11 months. It's very hard when you leave. But because they do an outreach program, I was then in their outreach program for 3 years.
And do you have somewhere to move to?
I had a flat. And actually, the way the therapeutic community works is that at weekends, you would actually go back to wherever you were living before. They want to try and get you back into life and society. The Castle Hospital, which is an incredible place, it is expensive. But in the long term, 5 years before the Castle Hospital, 80% of my time is in acute mental health units, which have cost an absolutely huge amount of money. I haven't done 5 years since leaving the Castle's outreach. I finished in 2016. I've had no hospital admission. I now only see a consultant psychiatrist. I've now even gone back into nursing. And you think, that's not even 5 years after leaving the Castle. We haven't even reached that yet. Sometimes, so we need to think about long-term treatments for people. My treatment was 4 years, but actually, its benefits have been massive.
And was it that which made your ambition to return to nursing? You could maybe see it a bit more.
Yeah, I think so. And also for me, as I tried to return to nursing, it was really hard. You know, it took 2 years from deciding to apply and applying to do my return to nursing, which is like a 6 month course, to actually starting my actual job in the hospice on the 11th of March. And as I went through it, there were obviously some people who really felt that I could do this. And then there were other people, you know, doctors that I met who didn't think I could, insisting on me seeing a private psychiatrist for them to say, actually, I could do this, which I thought, if this had been a physical illness, would they be asking me to see a private doctor to say, yes, okay, you can go back to nursing? Because there was a part of me that thought, oh, it's okay, you know, if I'm not a nurse again. But then there was another part of me that thought, but this is a real disservice to the Castle Hospital. You know, they're an NHS hospital. This is the treatment they gave me. And you know what? It worked. Do we not believe that actually therapy can work? I became really determined then. I thought, I'm not just doing this for me. I'm doing it for them. I'm doing it to show that people can come through serious mental illness and they can learn how to manage their mental health. You know, I may always be vulnerable to mental health difficulties, but I know the early signs. This is not a sentence for the rest of my life.
It's interesting that you were so determined to return to the nursing, even though the previous, definitely 5 years, were not a nice experience of the medical side.
Yeah, I think it wasn't a nice experience, but at the same time, I have a real heart for nursing. And I know that there were nurses in the difficulty of that system who really cared. One of the things that I had to work through in working in the hospice was actually how different their garden is. You know, garden, like literally in the mental health unit, isn't a garden. We used to call it the yard. And then I went to the hospice and I was like, oh my goodness, you know, it's got this gorgeous blossom tree and it's beautiful and the gardeners come in and they volunteer. And we didn't have that in the mental health unit. And I had to just sit and cry because I thought, it's really great the hospice has got this, but I wish mental health units had this as well. And I don't know whether part of it's because people don't know that there's hope for people with mental illness. And I think that's one of the reasons why I want to share my story.
As you said, your new job was at a hospice, which to me sounds like quite an emotionally tough job anyway. How did you prepare yourself for that and also for the first day back at work?
For me, I think it's realising that that was my dream. And there was a part of me that was always drawn to it. I was drawn to embroidery and I was drawn to nursing where you have the space to really care for somebody. I mean, I was never going to be an A&E nurse. Now being given the emotional tools, I still want to be a palliative care nurse. And yes, it is, but there's also something very beautiful about palliative care nursing. And it's about trying to give what you can for families and a patient in the last bit of their life. And also I think for me it's realizing it's not my pain, and to be able to stand with a family and a patient through that pain is a very privileged position. You know, the nurses that are drawn to that sort of work are very caring, and I've always said if I'm in a caring environment I thrive. And when it came to preparing myself for my first day, I was actually really looking forward to it because the lady who interviewed me really just believed in me. I mean, she just could see some of the skills that I'd learned through my own illness that could actually be really beneficial to palliative care, which might actually be really helpful. And that was wonderful. And she was going to be my mentor. So on that first day, I was like, oh, great, I'm going to be working with Margaret. There is anxiety. But to be honest, I just sort of went in and just said, yeah, I've come back to work after 12 years of illness. And people don't then normally ask very much. Now some of them are sort of like knowing. It's just been a joy, really. And it seems a really strange thing to say when actually it's a tough time for nursing at the moment with everything that's going on. But for me, where I thought I would never be a nurse again, and I look up into the mirror while I'm washing my hands and I think, oh my goodness, we did it. You know, and I say we because it wasn't just me. It was so many people.
Has the pandemic made hospice care any different?
Yes.
I guess there's maybe limited family and friends that visit. So you're even more important.
Yeah, and I think that's the hardest part. We've gone down to just one visitor. And that's really hard for families when they've then got to choose who it's going to be. You're not having those moments where you might have a birthday or an anniversary and you try and do a bit of a party so you have that kind of memory. You're also wearing masks and you're wearing gloves and aprons. hospice care is all about humanity. And for me, that's the toughest part, because I know that my mental illness was kind of unresolved grief. And a really important part of hospice care is not just the patient, but it's also the family, helping them have a good goodbye. If you're not able to do that, one of my worries, and also one of my worries for like funerals and things, where people are not being able to say goodbye, that's really tough, knowing that my mental illness came from grief, where I didn't really say goodbye. And I think that it might be quite a struggle if they feel like they haven't been able to say goodbye in the way they would have liked. I find that quite heartbreaking. As the years go on, I think that will be some of the pain that is left behind by coronavirus.
And we mentioned also that you're now an expert by experience in the eyes of the Royal College of Nursing.
I wrote to the Royal College of Nursing, this was before I returned to nursing, and I said I had been a nurse and I had a real heart for nurses. You know, how do we care for nurses? How do we teach nurses to look after themselves? And so started doing talks with nursing students at different universities. And so then I wrote to the Royal College of Nursing and said, look, also, I'm quite interested in just working with you. And then I worked on their Parity of Esteem programme, which is basically trying to, nobody ever really knows what that means. It's just trying to lift up, say it's on an equal level, mental health and physical health. But also we should be thinking of both. Whenever we look after any patient over anything, even if somebody's hurt their foot or something, you know, that might have a mental impact for them because they're a dancer. And when I started working with them, I then met the mental health lead. And then when I became a nurse again, she then said, look, I'm thinking about creating this new role, the first expert by experience nurse, which basically all that is that I'm a nurse who's willing to say that I've had a serious mental illness.
And also generally, it's obviously a very difficult time for everyone. Have you got any skills or tools that people could maybe use or think about?
I think one of the things I am sort of worried about are people who are mentally unwell and at home, because it's so isolating anyway. And I think that if you feel able to have people ring in and talk to you, I mean, I know in my illest, I didn't want to talk to people on the phone. But I know that one of the things that helped me is when friends used to send me messages and say they were thinking of me. When it comes to nurses, some of the things that I'm doing for myself is that at the end of a shift, I always write down my feelings. Feelings are painful, but feelings are actually, I think, a tool to try and help us what's going on for us. So if I feel angry, why am I feeling angry? And to explore it a little bit, which are my feelings? Which have I been transferred onto me by maybe a relative or a patient? And I have a little bit of reflection time. That really helps me because it makes me understand what might be really going on for me. I can deal with that. Or I might think, oh, actually, that thing I might need to talk through with somebody. And then the other thing for me is that I do mindfulness. And I know it's sort of bounced around quite a lot. And some people then say it's not that helpful. The first time I did it, I did a breathing mindfulness and absolutely couldn't stand it and thought, oh, this mindfulness is a load of rubbish. But actually, there's loads of mindfulness techniques. I do mindfulness colouring as well. And it's not just colouring in. It's that you actually think about how hard you're holding the pencil, how much you're pushing down on the paper. My brain then goes out of that ruminating thinking. It takes you to thinking, what am I feeling now?
You mentioned a couple of times your embroidery as well. And before nursing, you went to the Royal College of Needlework.
Yeah, part of me wants to be a nurse. And then I had this absolute love for embroidery. Ever since I was about 6 years old, I would just do little cross stitches and I just loved it. And I went and visited when I found out about the Royal School of Needlework with my school, and I just fell in love with it. I mean, it's at Hampton Court Palace, and it was all these embroidery techniques that I had never seen before. And actually now it's a real joy to have my embroidery. It's my relaxation. Not only that, being associated with the Royal School of Needlework has meant that I've done some amazing projects. One of those was actually when I was really, really unwell. Friends from the Royal School of Needlework who really tried to support me said, come and work on this project. And my friend said, I can't tell you what the project is, but she said, as soon as you walk in, she said, you'll know what it is. So I walked in and everything was white. There was white lace everywhere. And it was actually the Duchess of Cambridge's wedding dress.
Oh my God.
And I only worked on it for 8 days. Wow. on it for 8 days because I was so unwell. And it was a wonderful, wonderful thing to work on. But actually what then happened was that I went back into hospital and the Duchess of Cambridge actually came after her wedding to visit the Royal School of Needlework. And I was actually under section, so I never actually did meet her, sadly. And at that time, when I said that I'd worked on her dress, one of the nurses actually thought I was deluded. Oh. And I remember. And so now I actually use it as a story to say that you lose your identity with mental illness. You really do. And it's really nice you've asked me about the embroidery, because that actually was a really beautiful thing for me to work on at that time when I was really, really unwell. And I'm really thankful that the Royal School of Needlework allowed me to work on it. It will go with me for the rest of my life that I got to work on that project.
Thank you so much, Hannah, for chatting about all of your experiences. And thank you also for being one of the many brilliant people working so hard on the front line. That's it for this week's Cabin Fever. If you do want any information on mental health support, there are places like Mind and Rethink you can visit. And also, Rethink is carrying out a survey to get a real-time snapshot of the nation's mental health during this pandemic. I'm sure they'd love it if you got involved too. Don't forget, there are also other Ouch original podcasts to listen to. You can catch up with Kate Monaghan and her family as they reach the midway point of their initial 12 weeks of shielding. That's on The Isolation Diary. And there's a whole load of other brilliant Ouch podcasts, non-coronavirus related, just waiting to be listened to on the BBC Sounds app. Also, do get in touch. We're BBC Ouch on Facebook, at BBC Ouch on Twitter, and ouch@bbc.co.uk on email. Speak to you soon. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.